Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I write about food, and my favorite part of what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. Every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations live on air, bringing the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by interviewing some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Wednesday at 2 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, which wraps up the spring/summer season, I'll be talking to Victoria Granoff, one of the most respected and in-demand food and photo stylists in the business, famous for creating some of the most evocative food photographs in history. In the second segment, I'll be joined by Carrie Diamond and Claudia Wu, the founders of Cherry Bomb, to talk about the most current issue and what's coming up for the next year. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Julia.
Thank you so much for coming here. This is, I think you're an ideal Cherry Bomb community member to help us wrap up this season.
Oh,
we're so happy you're here.
Thank you.
We were talking just before the show about sort of how you got your start in food styling, but we've decided to direct everyone to the first issue of Cherry Bomb magazine, where there's a great interview that Christine Mielke did with you, where you tell that story, which is pretty hysterical. But we're going to go even further back, because what you were just telling us was so interesting about your DNA testing. So tell us why you recently got your DNA tested.
Well, I guess in an effort at reconciliation, the Spanish government is, I'm part Sephardic Jewish, and my people were kicked out in 1492, and to make reparations and to fill their coffers, the Spanish government has legislation out on the table to offer Spanish citizenship to descendants of those Jews who were kicked out in 1492, and you have to be able to prove it in some way. So I did the DNA test to prove that I do indeed have Iberian blood.
And was that something you knew before through your lineage? Or
I did.
Yeah, okay.
I did.
So this confirmed.
It confirmed it, but it was the smallest portion of my DNA, and I had assumed it would be my largest portion. And it
wasn't. So interesting. I wanted to ask you about the DNA testing, A, because it's sort of fascinating that you just went through that. But B, really going, usually on the show when we get people's sort of biographies, it's like, how did you get your foot in the door with whatever the occupation is? But this is really like...
500 years
ago. And being someone who's been working in the food and sort of design world for so long, did getting this information, has that adjusted any of your approach to eating, cooking, thinking?
It's affirmed it.
Yeah.
It's affirmed it. And, you know, I think I have olive oil running in my veins now, but it's affirmed it. It hasn't changed anything, but, you know, it makes me dream of that little seaside home in the south of Spain now more often.
But
where I'll cook.
That's a fun dream.
I will cook.
That sounds great. So going back to sort of your career, I'll just sum it up pretty briefly from what I've gathered. So your background, you studied visual arts. You started through a relationship with a food photographer. You started working in food styling. And you worked as a pastry chef, a cooking instructor. But in food styling, it sounds like you really found this career where design, visual art, cooking, they all collide. I wanted to know a little bit about when you first started. I know that you had offered to assist a stylist without pay. And to me, that kind of gesture shows so much interest and curiosity and passion for, you know, this new field. Do you now get contacted by people wanting to assist you?
I do. And in fact, I just had a wonderful girl come assist me. And she had come because she was more interested in the cooking part of it. And then I put her to work making something that, you know, it was just this amazing, she came up with an amazing result and surprised herself in you know, in a way where she could actually see the artistic value in it. And she could see her own kind of vision unfold through the food, but not, you know, the food as a medium to express herself. And it was really amazing to see that. You know,
that must have been quite a moment for you, having done that for so long, to watch someone experience that for the first time.
Yeah, then I've had some real slackers, too. But, you know, you have to give them a chance.
Two questions. One, where are people finding you and how do you find them? And then also, what do you look for when you're hiring an assistant?
Well, I do a lot of, I mean, they, I guess they find me, I don't know, they find me on social media, I guess. You know, I'm a little bored with Instagram now because it's just everybody's favorite.
What are you excited about?
Okay, what am I excited about? I'm excited about things that I've never seen before, or things that I've seen but not looked at in the same way before. You know, if I see one more heirloom tomato tumbling out onto a rustic table, I'm going to scream. I don't need to see that anymore. And sunsets and beaches and all of that. But because we're all looking at that the same way. Mm-hmm. But, show me something that makes me look at, you know, makes me change the way I see things. That's what I like to see.
And do you, being such a visual person who's so tuned into that, do you feel like you're seeing new things on a daily basis, on a monthly basis? How often do you feel excited about?
Oh, God, I see them in my sleep. I have visions. I do. I really do.
That's great.
I really do.
Do you keep track of that? Do you, like, write it down when you wake up or anything?
I know, I'm supposed to keep a journal next to the bed so I can wake up. And, you know, but I'm half asleep when I'm dreaming those things. And so I think they just kind of enter into my subconscious and become expressed in strange ways through my work.
Sort of like in your mental filing
cabinet.
Yeah, pull them
exactly,
out later.
Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about something else that you mentioned before the show, just about the sort of collision of art and food that you find in your work. What are your observations about the sort of cultural shift about food and art? You were talking pretty eloquently about it earlier.
Yeah. You know, it used to be that food and cooking was something that you did because out of necessity. And you, out of hunger and necessity, and to get food on the table. And there was no, it was all about personal gain. There was no, you know, there's no partaking of it out of pleasure. I mean, if you liked, you know, if you liked the smothered pork chops you ate, then that was great. But it wasn't the expectation. The expectation was you would get your belly full. And, you know, there were economic needs. There was all that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have art, which you don't touch in its classic sense. And it's just supposed to be an object for kind of sustained aesthetic gratification. There's no personal gain in it, and you don't eat it. You know, there's none of that. And in the middle is kind of where I find myself, mm-hmm. where, yes, you can still eat the food, but you're beginning to look at it as, you're beginning to be able to appreciate it for its aesthetic qualities and as something that, you know, is just visually gratifying. And I think that's also where we were talking about earlier, where, you know, the wine tasters and the coffee tasters and the tea cuppers and all of those people come in, they spit the food out. They don't even swallow it. Mm-hmm. So they're appreciating.
It's not even about that first
it's
necessity.
No, it's not. It's not about the visual of it, but it's about, you know, with art, art demands that we look at that it has complex characteristics and elements that demand a trained eye to appreciate it. And it's the same thing, you know, if you've got a complex tea, you need to have a cultured palate to be able to appreciate its complex components. So,
and in this sort of Venn diagram of food and art, with you sitting really, like, wonderfully in the middle between those two, I think everything you're saying speaks so much to your work, especially because you're really known for having the sense of discovery in your work. A beauty is where you find its sensibility. And I know you've said your styling isn't about the food, it's about the emotion. Mm. I was wondering if, is that something, because I'm going to back up a little bit. A lot of food stylists, if they're hired to do a job, it's, you know, maybe a food magazine or a cookbook mm-hmm. or something like that. You're hired to make the complete recipe to show it. A lot of your work isn't even the full recipe. It's just maybe like a beautiful moment of an ingredient or something. It's these emotional sort of gestures using food. And I was wondering if this whole sensibility, is that something that clients ask for when they hire you, or is that generally something that you have to convince people to get behind?
Do you know, I don't even know if they know in a lot of cases that I'm going to take them there or that that's what they need. somebody once said that, one of my clients said that, I go off on a tangent while staying on brand. So what I like to do is take a brand or take, you know, whatever my subject is, take it and kind of reduce it down to its most emotional elements so that it's really creating a very direct connection between whoever's looking at it and what it is. So it is about the emotion.
Yeah.
It really is about the sensation.
And what's your process of doing that? How much time do you spend sort of planning the image before it's shot?
Sometimes we sketch it out and we spend a lot of time, and I'll go shopping for props and I'll, you know, research and do a lot of things, and then we'll get there and it's just, that's not the way mm-hmm. it's speaking to us, you know. And I think when I first saw my son, I thought I was going to name him Milo, and that's the only name I had. And then when I looked at him, I said, oh my God, he's not Milo. I have to come up with another name. And that happens so much.
So it sounds like a lot of your work is about your instinct, your intuition.
And yeah, and it's also difficult. You know, you have these pre-production calls on the phone, and you've got a PowerPoint presentation, and they're asking for your thoughts on, you know, what you're going to do. And I'm kind of lost at that point because I'm not connected with what it is. I'm not there in person.
I kind of feel like sometimes before I go somewhere I haven't been, if I look at a map of that city or place, mm-hmm. wherever I'm going, you know, I think maps are beautiful. I enjoy looking at it, but it's right. like I have no sense of where anything is. But if I spend like an hour walking around that place and then I look at a map, all of a sudden it all makes sense to me.
Exactly.
So it sort of sounds a little bit like that
it
kind
feels
of feeling.
Like that to
yeah.
me.
Mm-hmm. Do you, in sort of working towards getting to the emotional kind of core of the recipe or story you're working on, are you usually given the entire articles or manuscripts for the images you're asked to produce?
I am, because I ask for them. Mm.
So is that not something you typically
no.
would receive? Okay,
mm-mm.
That's interesting.
And when I work with a new client, it's sometimes a little bit of a dance because if they don't know me, they expect that they will give me my directive and then I will carry it out, not realizing that it's essential for me to be involved in the whole picture, you know, in the whole, I don't have to sit
like,
in that.
Theoretically, yeah.
Theoretically, you know, I mean, I'm not taking the picture, but it's important for me to speak to them and talk to them at a more conceptual level about it and, you know, get behind it.
So you like to
not
get
just execute
into the job as early as possible.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
I think there's something really interesting, and you've sort of been hitting on it when you're talking about just being, you know, maybe on a photo shoot and you keep referring to us and not just you. And I think there's something fascinating about sort of the collaboration that comes with your profession, like just out of necessity, because you rely on another person, a photographer, to capture your work. And
a whole team.
Yeah. And they rely on you to mm-hmm. create something to capture. And I'm sure you've worked with so many photographers. You've famously had a decade-long relationship with Irving Penn. Did you feel like with him, or just photographers in general, there's a conversation?
Sometimes nonverbal.
He's sort of was famously silent. Is that right?
Yeah, but I think one of the gifts that I've been given is intuition. Mm. And some of it is not even intuition. It's just listening to what people say. So if, you know, if I'm in a meeting with somebody, a client, and they say the word lemon three times, and then I say, would you like me to bring lemons? And they say, oh, no, we're not going to do lemons. I'll bring the lemons. Because they don't even know what they're saying.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm listening to subconscious being just expressed through them. And they don't even know that that's what they want a lot of times. And
do you in
listen.
Those moments, I'm always so interested in the logistics of this kind of process. Is that like a note you write down somewhere? Is that just something you store kind of in your memory?
I have to write it down. Yeah. If you were to see where my notes are, I make a valiant attempt to put it in my reminders in the iPad. The more devices I buy to help me remember, the more I have like little bits of envelope.
Scraps of paper.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. That's so funny. What do you, in that moment with a photographer or a client, I've been really curious about this, because I think it sounds like you're someone who really has such clear and sort of unbelievable visions for how things can look. How do you get someone to get on board with your idea if you're getting pushback?
I say to them, let me give you what it is you're asking for, and then let me do what I want to give you.
Do you say that, or do you
I
just
do say that?
That.
Yeah. I do say yeah. that, but it's important that it's done without. I'm like a big egotist saying that it's important you do it without ego. But it's I think that they let me do it because they realize it's not an ego. It's not going to be a battle because I'm in it for the good of the picture. So they understand that I'm trying to give them the best picture possible and not that I'm just trying to have my way.
Yeah. And your life, your career is about creating these pictures on, you know, on a regular basis, as opposed to having something that needs a picture created for,
right,
where
right.
it like might not be their day job. This is what you do. Mm-hmm. This is your job. This is, you have so much experience. So I think it's wise to trust you.
Yeah. There you go. And there's trust.
I want to talk about another important element of your work, which are the ingredients you use.
Mm-hmm.
Talking again about that article where Christine Mulkey interviewed you in the first issue of Cherry Bomb, she really spoke, especially at the beginning of the piece, about how much of your work depends on sourcing and the relationships with shops and purveyors, even neighbors who, I know she mentioned, grow cherry trees that they let you
yes.
pick from. In that piece, she mentioned two other stories that I thought were amazing and I think worth mentioning. One was about you sourcing a gigantic, I think a 14-pound lobster for a shot that you did with Irving Penn.
It was my first shot with
the
him.
The first shot.
My first job. Yeah. And my hand was in the picture, too.
And it's your hand holding this gigantic lobster
mm-hmm,
caught. That's,
mm-hmm.
It's the size of your hand. Is
mm-hmm.
that right? And then in your other hand, you've got this
hammer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when you bought the lobster, you told them it was for a science experiment.
For my son, yeah, who I did not have at the time.
And then you also once got a live
turkey. Oh.
For a photograph about turkey necks. And was it true you bought the poultry vendors? Was their pet?
It was a pet. It was a live poultry place out in Corona, Queens.
Unbelievable.
And they had, but not only poultry, they had goats, and I don't know. They were just hacking the heads off of everything out there. And so we needed an old turkey, and it was in June, I think. There are no old turkeys in June. But they had this one that had become a pet because, you know, they hadn't sold it, I guess, after Thanksgiving, and it just got so old they kept it. But it was perfect. It had this knobbly neck, and it was exactly. So, yeah, and so I had to take it live in the trunk of a Big Apple limousine out of there and then have it killed.
That is unbelievable. Has there ever been a line that you just couldn't bear to cross when it comes to sourcing?
I can't kill anything myself.
But you find people who do. Who?
But I can find people who will do it.
Who took care of that turkey for you?
It was the photo assistant's mother, this elderly Greek woman in Queens. Yep.
That's so funny.
Yeah, she had no compunction at all.
Has there ever been an ingredient that you couldn't find? One that you're still looking for?
There are things that are illegal to import, like acai berries and things that don't travel, like plumeria blossoms, that they just are so delicate they don't travel. You know, I mean, I've got some illegal things, too. But, no, nothing I can't find. Things that I can't find when they're out of season, you know, like figs and pomegranates.
Do you do a lot of, ordering from other parts of the country and stuff like that?
I do. I have a couple of people in California, horticulturists, who, you know, they'll go out and forage for what I need. But there are also, you know, there are also those moments where you just can't get it and you have to move on to something else.
Yeah.
But, you know,
sort of like knowing when to let go. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've convinced little tiny growers to go out in their fields and pick, you know, five black currants in Oregon for us and send them overnight. You know, you have to be a pleasant person. But,
and
yeah.
Sort of willing to go
right.
many extra miles.
Exactly.
Do you, all these sort of, you know, having these established relationships, so you have someone you can call if you need a certain thing grown or picked and sent to you and stuff. Are these connections that you feel like you make as you need them, or are they ones that you're just always building? And
a little bit of both, maybe. I mean, I do have a kind of a core group that I go to most often, but you know, I mean, I know where to get my black chickens in Chinatown, and I know there's a, you know, there's certain places, but, you know, then I don't like to get too complacent about that either. I like to try new sources and find new places that, you know, because then you just keep getting the same product over and over and over.
And how much of your time working do you spend shopping?
Not much. I actually have really good assistants who do that.
That's something you delegate
mm-hmm.
at this point.
That's something I delegate.
So are they sort of discovering new places, or are you sending them to your sort of...
Oh, they're discovering
yeah,
new... They're on that Google.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. They're on Google all the time.
That must
all
be exciting
the time.
For you to find out new things.
It is.
Them. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Oh, there's
awesome.
So many crazy things. Yeah. One time we had to find Siberian garlic
What is Siberian garlic?
I don't know. It's like just a different kind of garlic. It didn't taste much different to me. But you know, we found somebody in Ohio that was growing it on the brother-in-law and a sharecropper. I mean, there was a story behind that you couldn't believe. And we had to kind of, they had a lot of time to talk to us about it. And we kind of got to know the family over the phone before they would even send us this garlic. And then, you know, we'd call them up and chat and everything. And then, you know, how about that garlic?
I'm sure for a while to farmers and growers, it's like, mm-hmm. if it's something that's super special to them, they want to make sure it's
that it has a good home. Right, right.
That's so funny. I would love to try Siberian garlic. What about, in addition to ingredients, a lot of your work depends on lots of sort of tricks and sort of trade kind of secrets and stuff to make things look great. Do you, I'm thinking about things like, I know a lot of food stylists will sort of like rub wax on a piece of fruit to
That's Armorall.
Armorall?
Yeah.
Do you, I'm so curious about these tricks and I don't want to cross any line and ask you to reveal them. I feel like that's kind of like asking you your email password or something. But in just figuring these things out, figuring out to put Armorall on fruit, is that, do you invent these? Do they come from other stylists? Do you guys sort of trade secrets? Do you work on concepts at home before you go to a shoot? How do these tricks come to life?
Gosh, you know, when you're talking about planning and spending time at home before the shoot and everything, it makes me feel so deficient because I don't do any of that. I sort of...
But that's good. That means you have a life, right?
Yeah.
That's great.
But I mean, I kind of plant it in there, read the brief, plant it in there sometimes. And then, you know, if I have the luxury of just stepping into a job, just kind of step, you know, we do all our work, but then just kind of step into it and say, okay, now what are we going to do? Let's come up with something and, you know, getting the energy of the other people involved. And
yeah, I'm sure in a certain way, it's probably good not to overthink things.
No, because then it's just going to be so hackneyed anyway. By the time you get to it, it's not going to feel fresh or spontaneous.
Do you on shoots, do you listen to music?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I listen to I just listen to whatever's on. I'm not loving death metal. I don't pretty much almost anything. We had some Polish polkas on one day that were really fun to work
by. That's energetic.
Yeah, I don't know. Just whatever's on, you know.
That's so funny. I want to know a little bit about, I know you've done some work with video.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something
love
you
that.
Would love to do more of?
Yes.
Yeah. And tell me about the difference in how it affects you and your job. Creating images for pictures, for still images versus
Well, they just
video.
Have more life to them. There's just life. There's movement. You're working with, I mean, you're not working with dead weight. I mean, I love still life. Although we call it still life, and in other languages, it's natural death. The word for still life in Spanish and in Italian and other languages is natural death. But we're afraid of death in this country, so we call it still life. But
that's so interesting.
But it is really, I feel as though it's really more natural death. And in the best sense of the word, still life is. And motion is life. It's just a whole different, it's a whole different medium. It just allows the food to interact differently.
And so much, I mean, food is living and, and it changes. And I think I've heard a lot of, on sets with food that's being photographed, after a dish might be like fussed around with just too much. I've heard a lot of people just say, oh, it's dead. Like we have to do something new. And I think that sort of difference between still life and natural death is just such a poetic understanding about what you're creating. And speaking of the sort of poetic approach, I wanted to just close on a topic with that I've seen you mention in lots of interviews, and it's the concept of negative space, of white space on the page. And I love that. And I think there's something just incredibly elegant about restraint, of sort of not filling a page or a plate or your life, for that matter, with a billion things just because you might have space for them. Is this principle, is this something that you've always had, or is this something you've come to appreciate?
I've come to appreciate it. I think you do, you know, I think at the beginning of my career, I think it's with any career. You're just so excited. You want everything. You know, when you're in medical school, you want all the diseases that you read about. So, like, you know.
Talk about natural death.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you just want everything all at once. And then you learn what the essentials are. And you learn to take out bit by bit everything that doesn't define the character or move
like
the plot along. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's kind of, I took a screenwriting class once, and I never wrote a screenplay, but it was a good class because it taught us about the essentials of words and how you do not write a sentence, you don't write a word unless it defines the character or moves the plot along. And that's really, I think of that
so
often.
True for everything that's
created. True for everything, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very well said. Before we go to break, we're going to move to sort of lighter questions, which are the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which are a handful of questions we ask every guest who comes
on. Okay, all right, I'm up for it.
So no pressure, no worries. Seven questions. Number one, sweet or salty?
Sweet.
Two, what did you have for breakfast today?
One slice of inedible gluten-free toast with pastured butter and muscadine jelly that I brought back from a recent trip to Georgia. And coffee.
Georgia the state?
Georgia
or the
state.
The state. If I were to look into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
What would you be surprised to find? Order.
Maybe the gluten-free bread.
No, that's gone now. That's gone. Order.
Good answer. What's your go-to snack?
Oh, God. Almost anything. Salty. The
salty.
Snack is salty. Yeah. Salty, crispy, or salty, crispy, crunchy, or chewy.
Hmm. Everything.
Kind of.
What's your favorite time of day?
Oh, dawn, when the sun's rising.
And where do you want to travel to next?
South India.
And lastly, what was your favorite meal when you were growing up?
I'm so embarrassed, but I'm going to tell the truth. I don't know, favorite, but it's the one that came to me first. Low quality ground beef cooked in a pan with creamed corn from a can that we had at preschool.
Mixed into it?
It was all mixed
or
in.
On the side, yeah.
No, and like, what difference did it make if it was mixed or sitting next to each other?
I guess that's, you get your sweet and salty.
I mean, the favorite was what my grandmother used to cook. She cooked really good Turkish food and chicken, rice with chicken. Very simple, but it had so much flavor in it.
That sounds great.
And love.
That sounds really great. Victoria, thank you so much for joining me on air today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with Carrie and Claudia.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tersh, and we were just speaking with Victoria Granoff, who I could listen to sort of all day. Now we're back with Carrie and Claudia, the founders of Cherry Bomb. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on to wrap up this season. That went pretty fast.
Does everybody know it's the end of season one?
We mentioned at the beginning, but a little hard to believe. But yeah, that went really quickly.
But I said to somebody, I think on Twitter the other day, it's not like HBO. Like, you're not going to have to wait until... I like July 2017 of like, for the next season. It's so not like funny. Girls.
Yeah, we have 2 weeks, I guess, and then we'll be right back.
Exactly.
It's been, the radio's been a great, I think, extension of the magazine, everything it stands for.
We should thank you. I know you're supposed to ask us, but we should thank you for doing such a great job.
Yeah, you made it really easy for us.
No, it's been, I love coming here. I think it's great. And it's a great, I don't want to say excuse, but it's the first word. I think it was a great excuse to sort of talk to all these women who do, people like Victoria, who are just my idols. So to get to talk to them is just...
Wait, you know what I thought she was going to say? It's a great excuse to
eat pizza. Oh.
I got a little pizzaed out.
Because that's, like, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
I got totally pizzaed out.
I never thought I would ever say that, but I think I'm... Maybe after 2 weeks it'll
come
back.
A break. Come back.
Let's talk about the current issue a little bit. The third issue with Ruth Reichel on the cover, who's never looked
so
better.
Excited.
What are you most proud of in this issue?
That we got it done, of course.
Good answer. I love the cover. I mean, I think people are really, really responding to the cover. Ruth looks like a supermodel. It's a fantastic photo. Jen Livingston did such a good job. And Ruth was so easy to shoot. I mean, she really was a dream. She was so game. She just went for it, let us treat her like a Barbie doll and put her in all these different outfits. And we even had a fan thing for her hair. It was a lot of fun.
That's so great.
She's fantastic. And she's really, I mean, she's an icon. She's also, I don't know, she's a big role model for me. I mean, I look at her and I see someone who's lived such an interesting life and continues to.
Yeah. No, I think I admire so much how forward moving and thinking she is. And I think she's someone who just has, even though she's had such a long, illustrious career, she still has so much energy, at least it seems to me. And sort of, I think it comes through in the photo itself. And it's kind of like what Victoria was just talking about bringing energy to still life mm-hmm. pictures. And you can feel from her that she's still, she's said so much, but she has so much she's going to say. So
it's a tough issue, though. I mean, I've joked a few times that the next one has been really hard to get started because I love the third issue so much. There's just so much in there. It's a huge range. I mean, I can't even, it's hard to even begin to pick a favorite story. But I feel very emotional about the third issue.
I think the first one that comes to my mind, aside from Ruth, is the piece about Judith Jones, which I just...
fabulous. Yeah, Sarah Franklin did a beautiful job on that.
Yeah. No, and I think it's amazing the variety that's in this issue in particular. And
we should talk about Judith Jones for a second for people who don't know who she is. She's in her 90s now. She's a famous, famous, famous book publisher. Basically discovered Julia Child, which in one lifetime is major.
Anne Frank's manuscript? Was that?
Anne Frank's manuscript.
Which is crazy.
She rescued it from the reject pile.
That is... Yeah. I had no idea until I read that piece. I thought that was... Yeah. I only know her from... I mean... Like, I'm in awe of her from her work in food and with Julia Child, but I thought discovering that was incredible.
Yeah, a lot of people have actually been surprised to tell me that they actually sat down and read the thing cover to cover, and I think that's really rare in magazines. Magazines just don't do long form anymore.
Unless you're the New Yorker.
Yeah. We have more pictures than the New Yorker, though.
I remember in the first issue, I had the opportunity which you set up for to interview Gabrielle Hamilton, which personally is one of my highlights of all time when it comes to my work and just getting to talk to her. And I remember her asking to read a certain portion of it, and then I didn't know what the protocol was because it was this brand new thing that you guys were making. And I remember asking you, Carrie, about if it was okay to send it to her, and your response was, "We're not the New Yorker."
Not to say we're not professional, but I do, you know what, it's kind of funny. There's not enough time in this interview to go into the difference between online and being print only, but I think a lot of journalists and subjects these days just take for granted that things can be changed at any moment if something is incorrect in a story. And we're in print and print only, and when it's out, it's done. Like, there's no changing any information that's already out there. So I think, not you, you're amazing. We love working with you. But there are a lot of, especially younger journalists, who don't really get the art of fact-checking and proofreading and things like that. So we sort of bend the rules journalistically in that respect. But I think it goes back to how Cherry Bomb isn't your typical magazine. I look at it more as a community. than just a magazine. And if that means letting someone read a piece before it runs, I don't think that's the end of the world.
No, I totally agree. And I thought for me in that instance, I respect Gabrielle so much. I think we all do. And I think knowing, I mean, I was never going to, there was nothing bad to say about her, but, you know, knowing that if I could share that with her and that would give her some sense of relaxation about it. And
yeah, it's always nice when there are no surprises when something comes out.
Yeah, for us and the subject.
All across the board. What do you wish you knew when you started the magazine?
Oh, gosh. So much. Where do we even begin? oh, my gosh. I don't even know. I wish... I didn't know it would be as hard as it is. I don't want to make it sound like it's hard and it's a bummer because it's so rewarding. I mean, personally for me, it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my whole life. I can't believe Claudia still talks to me because I think I'm a total pain in the neck to work with.
I'm glad Claudia started on the other side of the room, but she's moved next to you. So
and she's so deadline oriented and so great, and I can't thank you enough for trying to keep me on
track. Oh, I think I've given up on that, though.
I know you have. I'm sorry. And it's all my fault. But I had no idea how hard it would be. I really had no idea I would be carrying 35-pound boxes to the post office on a regular basis. All the little behind-the-scenes stuff with subscriptions and shipping and all that, it's hard. Really hard.
A lot of what you've described to me, the challenges that come with it are very physical. You're making this product that weighs a lot, and you get boxes and boxes of them, and getting them from one place to another, and I mean,
yes,
all the logistics that come with it.
We get a lot of emails from young women who want to do their own magazines, and we would never, ever in a million years discourage anyone from doing anything. But think about how many pages and how heavy your paper stock is. I think we might have chosen to do a pamphlet in retrospect.
But you now are incredibly strong. It's a cherry bomb workout. What has been the most rewarding part of it? What makes all that sort of work worth it?
I think with any project, it gives you a sense of purpose. I think that's the most important thing that I get out of it.
For me, it's been the reaction. I've never worked on anything that people have had such an emotional reaction to. And we get beautiful emails, beautiful handwritten letters. We get all these things from people who tell us how much they loved it. I think we help move the conversation forward a little. You know, last year was a big year in terms of women in food and recognizing their contributions. And I think now it's very hard for anybody to produce a magazine, produce a conference, do an event, do something, and not include women in food. And as little as a year ago, that was an acceptable thing. And I think now people think harder about it. And they've also got us to call them out on it if they...
Sort of like an accountability
exactly.
factor. Yeah. Earlier you described Cherry Bomb as being sort of more than a magazine and like a community. Is that something that you're working on more? Is it creating more conferences and stuff? Or
we have
like
some
bringing
ideas.
This community together?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, doing events that people can come and share and not just, you know, a product that comes in the mail or you pick up at a store is really an important thing for us to grow. And, you know, that whole sense of community kind of like goes along with that.
We'll definitely do Jubilee again next year, so stay tuned for that. I think Radio Cherry Bomb is a big part of that. And just to give you more credit again, Radio Cherry Bomb was Julia's idea, just so everybody knows that we
had nothing to do with
all,
it.
All for
not
the
our
pizza.
Fault.
No, it kind of reminds me about when Sue Chan was on the show, who we love and who runs the Toklas Society. And she spoke a lot about just the power of bringing women in this industry, in this community together, just to let everyone talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And I know when you guys launched the Jubilee, I remember talking to you about just having this great reason to bring everyone in one room and for people who didn't know each other but maybe wanted to work together and things like that, just to have a place for those connections to happen is pretty wonderful just for the industry. I think it pushes all of our work forward.
Definitely. I also think so many people in and around this world we've created and that we're in are entrepreneurs. And I think it's so hard, whether you might not think you're an entrepreneur if you're a freelance writer, but you are. And I think it's such a unique experience that it's nice to bring all these people together who, you know, are out there hustling every day and trying to make things work. And And just to have this support system to know you're sort of not in it alone.
And you're not the first one who's done it and stuff like that. I was just talking to my wife, Grace, about this, about because I've always been self-employed as a freelance writer and sort of coming around to the realization that, like, I guess I do run a small business. Like, I am it. And, like, there are taxes and all those things that come along with it, but also just the networking element of that and just getting mentors and advisors and stuff like that and being able to give other people advice. And it's great to be part of a group that really facilitates that.
Yes.
On to lighter, funner questions. Funner is not really a word, but... the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A.
We weren't sure if you were going to subject us to
think,
this.
No, I think you guys have to. I think it's the best way to...
And you would think that after listening to all the segments, I would know what the questions are, and I kind of forgot what most of the questions
I'm going
to
start with one that isn't on the normal roster, but because you brought it up earlier, I'm going to ask you the Amber Waves Farm question because it came up on their show. What is the next kale?
Collards. I have to answer that. My boyfriend Rob would break up with me. He's from the South, and we have a little southern place called Wilmajean in Carroll Gardens, and he really believes strongly that collards are the next kale, and you can eat them raw.
Rob does a great job with them.
I'm going to say purslane.
Good one. let's see. Claudia, sweet or salty?
I think
both. She's still laughing at her answer. And Carrie?
Oh, wait. Sweet or salty? Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Sweet.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Claudia, what did you have for breakfast today?
Soft-boiled egg, smoked salmon, some berries, and some nuts, maybe?
You foraged.
I ate like a bird, and then I ate the egg.
My answer is so embarrassing. I was fortunate to be out at the beach staying with my girlfriend, Renee, and I wanted to take one last swim before hopping on the bus to come here. And I literally did not have 2 seconds to eat. And Renee kindly made a lunch for me for the bus, and she put some pasta in a Ziploc bag.
Was there a fork?
That I ate with a fork that I do need to return to her. So maybe I'm the only person who was ever eating bow tie pasta out of a Ziploc bag on the Hampton Jitney.
Sounds great. Claudia, if I were to look into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
Duck eggs.
And Carrie?
Surprised to find. I don't know the answer. I haven't looked in my fridge in a few days. But you know what? I live with a chef, so that's not a fair
who's
question for me. Who's very
so
neat. Yeah, you might be. Claudia would be surprised to see how organized our refrigerator is.
Claudia, what's your go-to snack?
Currently, fruit, probably. Or cherry tomatoes.
Yeah. And Carrie?
Right now it would be peaches. Mm. We were talking earlier, it's just been a fantastic year for peaches. And if you haven't had a donut peach, you have to have a donut peach.
Not to be confused with a cronut. Claudia, what's your favorite time of day?
I think right when I wake up in the morning, nothing is stressing me out.
Yet.
Yet, yes.
Yeah, I would say the same. I'm not a morning person. I wake up kind of late, but... you know, my boyfriend will make coffee. We'll listen to WNYC, just kind of hang out and catch up on the world.
That sounds good. And Claudia, what was your favorite meal when you were growing up?
I love my mom's dumplings, which I would help her make.
What kind of dumplings?
They're probably like pork and chive. I really didn't question the fillings. It's just like, you know, a blob in a bowl of raw stuff.
Beautifully described.
Beautifully.
Probably maybe my mom's tuna noodle casserole. She made that a lot. I loved that.
I think I've misunderstood food. I think it can be pretty delicious. Carrie and Claudia, thank you guys so much for being here and for helping wrap up this first season. Information about the magazine, including where to buy an issue, is available online at cherrybomb.com. And the Twitter and Instagram handles are the same. Cherry Bomb Mag.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria, who was on earlier, her website is VictoriaGranoff.com, and her Instagram feed, which she did say she wasn't that into anymore, but I think there's some good stuff on there, is at Victoria Granoff. As always, thanks everyone for listening. Radio Cherry Bomb is going to take a little end of summer break for 2 weeks, but join us in September for season 2.
Thanks, Julia.
Bye. Thanks, Julia.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.